You're listening to That Great Manc Pod, Greater Manchester's community podcast. Top one
Hi and welcome to our first Manc Spirit Arbury Festival special on That Great Manc Pod. Damien and I chat with Emma Greenwood, Youth MP for Bury, a very active activist. Climate action, Youth Strike Manchester and so much more. Massively passionate about making positive change in Bury, Greater Manchester, the UK and around the world. And for what it's worth, Damien and I are pretty sure she will. An absolute pleasure to chat with Emma. Give her a follow at Emma_YMP.
I'm massively proud. Every email I send out goes straight. I think it's the government. Every email I send out goes straight to people's spam filters. So they tell me.
I promise you I'm not ignoring you. I did not ignore it. But yeah.
Probably another one of these conspiracies that are flying around. There's plenty of them.
Oh yeah, to say the least.
Listen, thanks for this, mate.
No problem.
Firstly, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling a lot better, thank you. I can't get it off my chest. I've got a nice phlegmy cough, so apologies if I start, hacking during speaking. But apart from that, I'm feeling a lot better.
Oh, we cough and wheeze all the time anyway.
That's just what happens when you get over 50.
I'm aging too quick then, but yeah, I'm glad
I'm No, my lad, well, he got over COVID, and he wasn't too bad with that, to be fair. But he's had, well, they've all had it in my house, other than me. So my three boys and my wife have, and they've all been really rough. But yeah, he was really rough to the point where you're going, oh, it can't be that bad. But it was.
He's not milking it.
No, he's not milking it. No, not at all. And I'm recording this now. And it's just a, I don't know if you've managed to listen to any of the Great Manc Pod episodes.
I've listened to a few, the start and end anyway.
Right. Which one did you listen to? The one with the ICU nurses, Sheena and Petro, which was the last one?
I think it might have been an earlier one than that.
Right.
I'm not
sure. So you weren't offended by anything that was said?
No.
We're good at editing, so don't worry. Paul's got a whole blooper reel of stuff that we couldn't possibly send out anywhere.
No. Oh, a secret folder, no black box.
Yeah, it's our DEFCON 5 folder. When everything, we just go, oh, send it all out. Send everything out and just see what happens. Well, you know, it probably couldn't make the world a worse place than what it is at the moment if we did that, but... Listen, thanks very much for this. We appreciate it. We've got the festival is starting next, well, a week tomorrow, the Arbury Festival. So things are starting to come together, which is what we always say. What we really mean is it's organised chaos.
That's not right.
But, you know, it's just such a weird time at the moment. Damien was saying yesterday, you know, a lot of people are just really fed up.
Not this total, not apathy, it's just lethargic. Everyone in the community sector, I mean, I work with a lot of different community groups. Everyone's just burnt out is probably the best way of saying it. They've been paddling this canoe so fast for the last couple of years. Everyone's just gone, oh, I need an holiday, but I can't go anywhere.
Yeah. Well, I could go somewhere last week, but I can't go there this week.
Yeah, I can go there. I might not get back next week.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on, Paul.
No, so I was going to say, so the thing for us is, it's a real, I mean, this is generally the way we work, you know, it's a real opportunity next for the festival to get as much positive stuff out there as we can. Certainly people that are doing things and have been doing things, you know, during the last 2 years, but, you know, people haven't done stuff for whatever reason, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I just think it's nice to hear about all the positive stuff that is going on in communities across Greater Manchester, but specifically for Bury for this. So can you tell Damien and I, pretend we don't know, pretend we've never spoken before, and I didn't rudely interrupt you last time and say, no, don't tell us anything about you because that will ruin the podcast. So, Emma, can you tell us who you are and what you're about, really?
Sure. So, hi, both, or everyone. Hi, I'm Emma Greenwood. I'm a 17-year-old youth voice and climate activist from Bury in Greater Manchester. So I'm the current youth MP for Bury, and I have been since way back in February 2019. I think I was 15, which is very strange to think I started that young because it feels young to me now. But I also, in the same month, got involved in coordinating the Manchester Youth Strikes for Climate. So that you might have seen us on the streets in the past, but basically congregate in St. Peter's Square around once a month, obviously pre-pandemic, just to sort of come together, both young and old people, to push for climate justice. And I suppose to give people a mechanism to act on the climate anxiety that an increasing amount of people are feeling, and to sort of, I suppose, convey to politicians the importance that the general public see in taking climate action and how much it, kind of how much it means to people and how scared people truly are. As well as that, I've sort of grown since then to get involved in a lot of international stuff, including like the Fridays for Future international network, and doing a lot of stuff in Greater Manchester as well with the Combined Authority, and sort of getting youth voice into different decisions and making sure that any decisions that will impact young people actually include young people, because a lot of the time decisions are being made by 50-year-olds on behalf of 18 and like 14-year-olds, which to me seems crazy. So it's been good to get some actual young people involved in decisions.
I'm a 50-year-old, and I find it really strange that 80-year-olds are the ones that are setting the agenda. I mean, it's really frustrating when you're out there trying to do good stuff, but then I'm also looking to bring people through, you know, because me and Paul, you know, we're not going to be here forever. And it's part of what we do is encourage it. I mean, we've both got, between us, we've got five lads. So it's trying to get them to be active, take an interest in politics, take an interest in forming their future as well. Do you know what I mean? So I totally agree with you that you're looking at us going, that generation's really failed us, but we're looking at them going, well, actually, they failed us, do you know? And that's got to stop. That's people of all ages need to come together and have a proper discussion without, oh, we've paid tax for 50 years, so we're more important. Why? Do you know what I mean? It's the ideas and the inspiration. To me, this is a really positive time. It's not a negative time. It's a reset, you know, and it's a chance to finally do things differently. Do you know what I mean?
Completely. And I think there is this at the moment, there's quite a bit of a blame game between generations and a lot of like alienation. And I don't think at this point being like a bigger divide between generations, whether like social media has created that or whether it's real. But I think the biggest power we have at the moment is to come together, because you gain nothing from sort of going, oh, I'm not going to work with you because you're younger, I just don't understand you, or I'm not going to work with you because you're old and you don't know like the modern slang and you don't know sort of, you're not woke enough. And that in itself, that whole sort of culture that's being created, isn't helping anyone. And I think the biggest power can be found when we break that down, and when there are like 14-year-olds working with 70-year-olds, which is what I've done, had the opportunity to do as an environmental activist, because there's so much you can learn. Like, even if you're completely different people and have had completely different experiences, you both have so much to share with each other. And I think that can be really powerful when it's used in the right way, and when we sort of get past those, I suppose, barriers that society's created at the moment.
Well, I think you've seen that on the sort of international platform. At one end of the spectrum, you've got Greta Thunberg really sort of bringing it to the fore and that passion. But on the other hand, you've got David Attenborough, who's like championing everything, and he's just like, there's no stopping him. Do you know what I mean? But when you look at that, and if both of those voices are saying the same thing, there's got to be, you know, everyone's got to take notice.
The problem is, though, they're not the people making the decisions, are they? And those decisions are never made. They're never made for the right reasons. They're made for generally for the easiest route, and for money and for all that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's not an easy one. by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, we've always said, and my attitude has always been, I try and I'm not, maybe not always, maybe not when I was your age, I'd be honest, but I, you know, I try to learn things from everyone and anyone. And I think when you do get to our age doesn't become that important, really, unless you've got an ego. And a lot of people have got egos and they're not willing to learn off younger people because they think, what can I possibly learn off you? Loads. Loads. And vice versa. And vice versa. But it's that age group in the middle. It is the 50-year-olds, you know, it is the 50-year-olds plus, because they're the ones in the positions that are, they're in the ones in the positions of power more often than not. And it's always transient. They know they're not going to be there forever, so they're just feathering the nest and moving on. And listen, you can get really bitter and twisted and whinge about it, and we all like a whinge, whether we say we do or don't. But, you know, there comes a point where you've got to try and do something about it. And I don't know personally what that doing something about it is, but it has to start somewhere. Yeah. And I like being in town and seeing groups of whoever having a voice. And, in, you know, in some cases, I may not necessarily agree with what they're saying for all sorts of reasons, but I love the fact that, A, that they're in a country where they can do it, and that may change, you know, little bits are being eroded here and there, but the fact that you can go there and you can say that, you know, is really, really important. And that's Manchester, you know, it's not just Manchester, but that's a big thing about Manchester and the DNA of Manchester. I mean, do you feel that when, you know, with the stuff that you're doing, I mean, obviously I'm not comparing you to the suffragettes, that's quite a big thing to put on anyone, but that history is there of really strong women who won't take, you know, it will stand up and be counted. Does that have any impact on what you do?
Oh, a profound impact, if anything. That's why we chose to kind of gather in St. Peter's Square, because it is just within Manchester and the UK, such like a foundational place where democracy has been shaped, so whether it's like the Peterloo Massacre, suffragette movement, it's things that have been like integral in developing the society we have today. You look to them, and I think for a lot of young people and just activists as a whole and people working to better society, you can look at them and go, they were people that were faced with such poor odds, because obviously it was the suffragists before the suffragettes, and it was, they put in so much effort and they met so many barriers and so much sort of like, no, it's never going to happen, there's no point, so many people telling them to just give up and stop, and they did win it. And I think the importance of stories like that to keep activists and to keep social movers going is so important, because it is, as adults do tell us as sort of climate activists now, that just like give up, like it's never like give up and we're not going to do anything. It's just always that bit of like, oh, they're doing stuff, just let them do it in the time, and, you know, quiet down a bit, you're being really headstrong with young people. I get so much, but I think it's then when you use those examples of women who got told to quiet down and to stop, and that it may happen eventually, but it'll take time, so, you know, don't rush them. It's sort of using that and going, no, these women didn't stop, and they didn't kind of let people quiet them down. If anything, they got louder. And I think there's a lot of liberation and empowerment I get from that as a young person and a female young person, sort of keep pushing for what I am and keep going.
Well, me and Paul have discussed this a lot of times, because we have quite a lot in common, but the main thing is our main inspiration in our lives was our gran. You know, his nana meant a hell of a lot to him, my gran meant. And it's like, we've discussed this and we've looked at projects and we've looked at how we can sort of bring this to the fore. I think there's a lot of disrespect to the way when people look back and go, oh, women were quiet. No, they weren't. Absolutely. My gran was a crane driver, right? English Steel, when the war started, they're looking around, they need somebody, these massive high-rise cranes. And she went, I'll do it. And she went up there. She was a crane driver for all that time. And then when the war finished, she said, there's a lot of men that are coming back that need jobs, and she gave that job up. And they said to her, you're the best crane driver we've got. But then she was she ruled the family, but quietly, you know, She manipulated us all. She was absolutely fantastic at manipulating the whole family. And I know Paul's nana was a great inspiration to him as well, you know.
No, I mean, you know, there's a lot of powerful women. And you know, I'm not... There's a lot of groups that, and a lot of people that, that I'm sure we know a lot of the same people in and around Manchester who, you know, we are powerful women. And you think, well, you know, there's always been powerful women. There's always been people that have spoke up. I mean, certainly going back to, you know, my nan was a massive part of my, well, all the women in my life, my mum, my nan. So, you know, I'm quite used to, I mean, the only person who could say anything and I'd listen to would be my nan, you know, and it's weird, you know, even when, I mean, she died not that long ago, but a few years ago, but even when you know, you're in your 40s, she's telling you off and you're thinking, I've got a proper job and everything, children, you can't talk to me like that. But yeah, who were your heroes? Heroes, full stop.
I think I've got a lot, and I do think a lot of them are the women in my life and just the people in my life in general. My parents have been a huge part of it in, I suppose, raising me to be politically conscious and to be conscious of the society around me and aware from a really young age of the inequalities there are. And for that, I think it's a huge asset that I've had, because they've never hidden anything from me. And I've always realised, I've always seen the importance of the privilege I've had growing up, whether kind of economically, racially, obviously I'm white and there's a amount of privilege in that. But then they've always given me the, I suppose, confidence and the ability to go out there and use that and use my voice. And they've never told me that I'm not really powerful as an individual to help change things, and that I shouldn't fight for what I believe in and have that voice, and that kind of age doesn't dictate that. And I think the fact that they've instilled that within me and, I suppose, nurtured it in a sense and supported me in everything that I've done has probably been the biggest asset I've had. And it's the same for the rest of my family. My grandparents have been hugely supportive, and my gran's come to the youth strikes on like multiple times. She's gotten the training from
Rochdale. Did she bring butties with her?
Oh, she's bought everything. She's had, oh, she's coming all manners of weather. She doesn't leave, like, she lives over towards Rochdale. She doesn't leave much, but yeah, she gets the training and she comes into the city and sees me. And it's just, it's stuff like that, though, that I think has been so important, because it is difficult to do things on your own as a young person, because there's just everything inside of you and everything that you've been raised to believe is that you're a young person. You can't vote yet. You should really just be quiet. You don't know enough. You need to wait till you're older. Like, that is what you're raised to believe, I suppose, and what society tells you. So to overcome that is difficult, but having that support network of family and friends and the activist network has been kind of, yeah, hugely important in allowing me to do what I do.
Do you think that you've been involved in things and done things where maybe you, and you don't have to be going to specifics, where your parents have thought, oh, you know, I'm not really sure about this, but I would have supported you anyway?
Yeah, obviously the Police and Crimes Commissioner Bill, which is currently going through, which can put a lot of restrictions on protests. So things like excessive noise, which is a very, very subjective term for the police to use, makes it arrestable. So if we're in St. Peter's Square with a megaphone doing some chanting, we could be arrested. Like, that's not something that's kind of incomprehensible. And so obviously that was a bit like, you need to be careful, because there's a lot of things that come along with a criminal record. And I am only, you know, 17. I'm not old. And so there's always that bit in the back of the mind of like, what could happen if the police chose to do anything? Luckily, we've never had anything happen on a strike. We've always been pretty good and communicating with the police, but there is always that risk that's there. And I suppose that's just something I feel like I have to do, because I can't be quiet and because we can't afford to delay it. And especially because I've got a certain platform within the UK. I've got the freedom to protest. It's something that we can do, but people in places like the Philippines, protest is sort of punishable by death and by long prison sentences, and that's something they don't have the privilege of doing. And so I sort of feel like it's my obligation and something I have to do, because I've got this incredible platform and this incredible country which has such a big media presence internationally to push for something, and I feel like I've got an obligation to use that, and so I kind of, you know, take the risk as it comes.
Do you from think what I see, there's a lot more encouragement now for young people to get involved and roots into it. Because I think about, me and Paul both grew up in North Manchester, and I went to school and was told, you go to school, you get a job, you stay in it whether you like it or not. There was never any, the idea of getting involved in anything, politics, whether it was a different kind of job, a social worker even, do you know what I mean? It was like, you will go and work in a factory. And it became a massive turning point in my life is when I joined the trade unions, you know, and it because it was always in me. My dad had always inspired me. My grandparents have always inspired me to look at other people's points of view and weigh things up. It was only when I was in my 20s and I accidentally got involved in the trade union, more to, I think, avoid being in work more than anything at the time. And then next thing, this whole new world opened up, you know, of like, hang on, I can stand up for what's right. I can make a difference. I can change things. But it's really inspiring to see the opportunities that there are for people. You know, I'm always telling my lads, go and do something. Go and get involved in this. Go and join that. Go and be this. Go and... Nah, not interested. But if they did want to, I think that opportunity is there. So what opportunities are out there for the listeners? If they, you know, if there's anybody out there interested in getting involved, what would you suggest?
I think the biggest thing that my generation has got that maybe once before us didn't have is social media, which has been a huge enabler. Because I just don't think things like the Fridays for Future and Youth Strike movement could have grown as big and as quickly as it has without social media. And that is a huge asset that we've got that I think we're trying to use positively. So I'd say go out there and join grassroots organisations, join community groups, network. And the biggest power we have is together and through networkings and, as you said, unions. That's when we do the most. And there's this big focus at the moment, I think, on like individual action, which in itself is important, whether that's like reducing your plastic consumption, meat consumption, gardening, you know, all the stuff that we get told to do that I'm sure people have heard of. I think there's also this big focus on coming together and doing things because we aren't individually responsible for the climate crisis. It isn't on us. It's on the big businesses, kind of the 100 companies that are responsible for 71% of global emissions. They're the ones that are responsible. And so the biggest change that can be had is when we push for that sort of government-led legislative action against them. And so, yeah, joining a community group and networking in that sense is so powerful, and I've gained a lot from that because you get this support network of like-minded people who want to do the same thing. And instead of having like 50 different people emailing an MP about 50 different environmental issues, you've got 50 people emailing about one thing, and it does send a really, really powerful message. And in the past I've had meetings with ministers as a result of emailing my MP, and so never be sort of dismayed by sometimes your MP's lack of response, because it does get through to them even if they don't consciously realize it. So I'd say go out there and sort of use the power you've got to network and join as a community, but also to speak to your MPs and your councillors, and that sort of voting and political power, especially that over 18 adults have, which is really easy to grow sort of apathetic over.
Make yourself a nuisance. I mean, yes. You know, ultimately, I mean, certainly with MPs, anybody in those positions, if you really want to make, I've said this, if we'd ever met before, I think I probably would have said that, I mean, most of the big changes that I've seen in my life have come from grassroots. And I think this is, if we're ever going to see the changes that we need to see in terms of the climate, they have to come from grassroots. And I honestly, when I look at the issue, it's just mind boggling, and you just think, you know, I don't know what we do. I really don't. I don't know what the plan is. I don't know what the plan is for in the UK. I know, you know, we're constantly looking at targets. We're constantly not hitting those targets, and because I don't think we had were we ever going to meet those targets in the first place? No, probably not. So, I mean, where do you think we are in terms of how we deal with the climate crisis in the UK from a government point of view?
I mean, that's the loaded question, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is, as you said, it is constantly the government putting targets in legislation, not meeting them, but them just going by and nobody realising that we haven't met them, but them just passing. And this is a difficult thing because I think at the moment, the government haven't made that fundamental shift in going, the climate crisis needs to be the thing we tackle. At the moment, they're trying to like shove it onto the side of other things they're doing, which just isn't how it'll work, because the problem is the system that we've got is currently built on causing the climate crisis. So you can't avert a climate catastrophe without changing the system. No matter how much you try and fit it into the status quo, it just won't work. And I'm not saying it's easy, and it'd be really naive to think it was, but there just has to be this fundamental shift in the government attitude to prioritise tackling the climate crisis over other things such as money and the economy, which is always the focus of the government. And yeah, it's easy. I couldn't tell you how to do it. That's why I want to go to university and learn and explore that. And it's a big question, but there just needs to be that fundamental shift in government priorities, which I just don't think they've made yet. And no matter how much legislation, aims and targets they put in place until then, I don't think any of it will be impactful enough without that sort of much more drastic change in priorities.
I was hoping you were going to give us an exclusive then.
not quite. Keep
I was watching the Earth Shot last night, and I was just blown away. I knew there was stuff going on out there. I've been an activist all my life. I've been involved in things. And it was just like, these guys are so far ahead. And they were proving that it was economically a better thing to do. You know, it was this, I can't remember where it was, whether it was Denmark or one of those countries over there. They're doing the no waste. So you build a factory that uses the waste product or the one before it to make its products that then the waste products go. And I was like, hang on a minute, this is something out of SimCity or some computer game, the way they've... But that has got to be the model. You know, there is no waste. And the plastic eating enzymes, the work that he's doing, the waste in Africa, you know, human waste, and using that as fertilizer. You're like, wow, you know, incredible projects. I didn't watch all the way through. I don't know which one won. I know it was like a bit of a competition. But each of them, I mean, they were showing that it saved like £79 million for these factories by just linking up, you know. But that on a global scale, I'm not saying it's unachievable, but how do you take those incredible models and sort of spread that as a world model without sort of losing the identity of each country and ending up like the Hunger Games? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it does. The climate crisis as a whole just presents a whole new level of challenges that the world's just never had to face. And I've recently read a book called Long-Term Thinking in a Short-Term World, which is an amazing book. Highly recommend reading it. But it just, I think, especially with like globalization and digitalization, we're living in a really short-term society where like Amazon, one click of a button, you get something the next day. You never have to wait. It's just it's social media as well. It's just really short-term satisfaction. And for the climate crisis, that is really, really counterproductive, because obviously the climate crisis is a long-term issue. And so we need to look, I suppose, generationally at the importance of having those ancestors, which is something that like Indigenous groups do really, really well, because they see the earth as something they borrow rather than something they have. And something that sort of we're on the earth to help cultivate for the next generation and to pass on the sort of, I suppose, earthly affluence rather than economic affluence. And it is, I think, globally, we need to make that shift again to look in actually how can we support countries, individual cultures and individual mechanisms, but also turn them into something that's helping future generations and creating a world and a country that is there to support them and leave them with a better world than maybe we were given when we were born. And yeah, it'll be a radical shift, and I'm not sure how we'll do it. And as you said, there's amazing people out there working on different things, but it's getting the investment into that, because it's not a lack of solutions, but a lack of people, specifically politicians and decision makers, wanting to invest and implement them. And I think that'll be what we might begin to see over the next 50 years is those being implemented. Well, hopefully.
Yeah, I hope so. Oh, I had a really, really good question then that came into my mind and then just left. That's what happened.
He didn't really. He's making it up.
No, I did. I did. I mean, I just thought, oh, that's going to get us number one in wherever, because we, you know, we are charting with the Great Mank. We were number five in Hong Kong with the Great Mank Pod.
There you go.
I don't know why. I don't know
maybe
why.
Maybe like Manchester. Manchester's a kind of popular place.
It could well be. It could well be. No, I think what I was, one of the things that we say in terms of the charity is when you do look at the bigger issues and it just get, you know, it's too much. It's too much when you look at the big picture and you think, okay, well, it's what we can only control, what we can control, what's in front of us. So what's local generally, local to us. So if we were looking at Manchester, I know there are various initiatives around and departments around that are supposedly dealing with the climate crisis. But as a city or as a borough, so you're in Bury, so what can Bury do as a borough to help with the climate crisis?
Well, Friends of the Earth very handily drew up like an environmental plan for every borough across the UK, which focuses on key issues such as like public transport infrastructure and home insulation, like drastically across all of the UK, was the biggest way in which boroughs are failing because of the sheer amount of energy that the UK uses in heating. We're quite, obviously, we're a cold country, as anyone living in the UK will know. And so we spend a lot on energy, but we have very poorly insulated homes. And I just don't think you realise quite until you look at the data how much that is and how much energy and fossil fuels and sort of like carbon impact equivalent that has. And so it may seem really trivial, but it is that sort of like this insulate group that's currently going on the M25, which is controversial in itself. But the thing that a little bit controversial, but we'll leave that. But it's that sort of thing that is the importance, and it seems trivial, but that in itself in the UK could drastically reduce our carbon footprint. But it's, I would say at the moment, it isn't being invested in enough, especially for like working class and even middle class people. It's definitely something that's only accessible to people with a high amount of disposable income. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every now and again, they did it a few years ago with the solar panels. You were getting various, and which is why, you know, you just see, walk past somewhere, see a load of solar panels on the roof. Yeah. Think, hey, especially in Manchester, I think it's the most, you know, we love irony in Manchester. Well, that's the most ironic thing ever, all the solar panels on the roof.
I'd like to go back. I'm not letting you get away, actually, because you've just got about the Insulate campaign and all that sort of stuff. And I watched that, and I've been active in trade unions. I've done a lot of anti-racism stuff back in the past and stuff. And for me, activism is about captivating people, about, you know, campaigning and getting noticed, but in the same respect, not pissing people off, because there's a fine balance between the two. I get it. There's an issue. There's an issue that needs to be discussed, highlighted, and addressed, but you need to bring people with you. So that, I see some amazing stuff, craftivism, and I've seen stuff with people knitting things and putting them around trees. And to me, that just, it puts a smile on my face, number one. It intrigues you and you think, who's put that on there? And that draws you in, you know, and that I'd love to do sort of a lot more of that kind of projects, and that's something that we could do through the charity anyway, and something I am looking at anyway. But there's that other side of it of, yeah, you're getting your point across, but annoying people and stopping them getting to work or dropping the kids off is not the way to get people sort of on your side. You know what I mean? What do you think about that? Do you need to go full one way? Do you need to go full the other way, or...?
No, I fully agree that I think the only way that we are going to tackle a climate crisis is by getting everyone involved, because everyone's affected, but everyone contributes to it as well. Obviously, different proportions, but everyone will inevitably be affected by it. And alienating and polarising people probably isn't the best way to do that. But equally, I think, especially when you're in the climate movement, it's really easy to get very angry and feel very, very stuck, because the government, as I said earlier, continues putting legislation, but it doesn't actually do anything. And when I suppose you're putting so much energy into something and you really, really want something to happen, but you're constantly just getting met with like empty promises and basically it's a blank wall, it's easy to just go, what can I do to just get this in the public attention? What can I do to just get media headlines and get it out there? And I think that's where they were going. I think some people are just really desperate to get the message out there and to make headlines, which is what they've done to their credit in a sense. But I would agree that I don't think alienating people, and especially yet normal people, these aren't people that are contributing greatly to the climate crisis. And these aren't people that hold a lot of power either to change anything. They're just sort of like, yeah, people who are at their whim. And so I think there's better ways it could be done. But equally, I sympathise with the anger and the sense of frustration that people can feel when they try and push for change, but they get met with constant inaction.
Great answer. You can admire the passion, but not necessarily the methods.
Precisely, yeah.
No, I mean, it is I'm actually a druid. So, you know, nature and the issues and everything. But I might have a slightly controversial view on this, that as
let
a druid...
let it out, don't worry.
Oh,
off you go.
And the more I've sort of thought about it and the more I've meditated on it and things like that, I think it's a bit arrogant of us as humans, that's a part of nature, to feel that we've damaged the earth, it could just shrug us off at any moment. You know, maybe we are part of the plan and maybe it is part of the evolution of what Mother Nature wants us to be a part of. Do you know what I mean? So that's my controversial view.
Well, it can well be right, but if people are, you know, if the land that they're living on is getting flooded, if, you know, the crops are getting destroyed, if, you know, that's the practicalities of it. And listen, if you've got a family, and I think more so, you know, if you've got a family, for most people, their priority is their immediate family and the kids. And not even, do I think of the future for my boys? Occasionally, I do. When you've got, 10 minutes on your own, you think, I wonder what they'll do. But more often than not, it's, you know, what we're doing tomorrow, what we're doing next week, what, you know, so it's that short-term thing. And that's the problem. We all think short-term, and it's probably human nature, or it's certainly the way we live nowadays. Like you were saying before, Emma, that, you know, people want things really, really quickly. And if there's no Wi-Fi, honestly, your life is not worth living. And, you know, that's a perfect example. Or, you know, if something isn't in HD or whatever, then, you know, I get all the kids have got farts on their faces and it's, you know, it's just really, really bad. So, yeah, it's how we how we change that. I mean, you know, we've looked at, it's one of the things, you know, as a charity, as a mental well-being charity, mental well-being, everything that goes on in the world, including it, absolutely including the climate crisis, affects people's mental well-being, as well as all the practical things as well. But that is definitely having an impact, people, more now than ever. So, you know, it has to be something that, as a charity, if we're serious about, you know, making some real changes, certainly in the, you know, Greater Manchester, it has to be something that we consider and we look at. And like I said before, but the simple truth to me is I don't know what we do or where we start. So, yeah, you know,
it's picking the piece of the jigsaw that we can actually deal with.
Yeah.
And that goes back to what you said, Emma, earlier about the collective approach.
I think, the fact that you're doing that in itself, I think, is the most fundamental and important shift that people can make, because every single person that's alive today has been raised in a society that is sort of like, right, what am I going to do next week? We've been raised in an increasingly short-term society. And so to consciously make that shift between consumerism and disposability to reusability and sustainability and long-termism, and just being conscious of the environmental impact of things, that shift that people make when you begin to look at sort of plastic that you're using on your kind of weekly shop and go, oh my God, that's actually quite a lot of plastic. Like, what can I do to reduce that? Mm-hmm. I think that is the most powerful thing that any individual can do, because when you become aware of the issue and how prevalent it is, that's when you begin to consciously make small changes to kind of make a difference in a way that's accessible and inclusive to you. And so I think people deserve way more credit when they do just make that cognitive recognition and then action on what they're seeing. And again, as you said, yeah, the fact that you're doing that as a charity as well, I think is the biggest step you need to take in becoming more environmental and sustainable.
It was more, I mean, it's that, it's how we step that up and how we bring other people along with us. I mean, I'm sat here feeling guilty as anything. I am drinking from a plastic bottle, right? But then as I'm drinking that plastic bottle, I'm thinking, what else could I use that for? You know, it doesn't have to, it can be part of a craft activity. It can be, if we could get people to use things that become something else, that to me, that's a small step change rather than just saying to someone, don't ever use a plastic bottle ever again. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely. There's some huge expectations on people. Like just the expectation of people to completely cut out meat of the diet within like going from eating meat 5-7 days a week to go eat, never eating it, is just not realistic. And it makes people feel guilty, but it's a sense of guilt where it's like such a big issue. You just sort of switch off and go, right, I'm just not going to do anything then because I just can't do that. But it's not, there's so much importance how much we need to think long-term and move quickly. Is doing stuff that's accessible to you and something that you can sustain as well, because it's well and good cutting out plastic, but if you can only do it financially for a week and then you're sort of, you know, low on money, that's not something that's sustainable to you. And that's okay, so you don't need to do that. But it is doing those accessible changes and then growing it slowly and through time and getting progressively doing more. But yeah, don't let, especially big companies who want to push the blame of the climate crisis from them to individuals and consumers, don't let them do that, because it isn't all on you and you aren't entirely responsible for solving it. But the little things that you can do and then grow to do more, it is more important.
Also, I think that you've got to have this, everyone's got to be more creative and there's got to be more options. I mean, at the start of last year, I was like, right, I need to be healthy. I need to start doing things. So I joined a veg box scheme, an organic veg box scheme. So I went, it was delivered locally. I went and picked it up with thing. Mate, after 4 months, I was so sick of parsnips. I didn't know what to do with parsnips. And it was like, everyone in the house is going, oh, you'd open the veg box, you go, oh, no, they're in again. Right. So we ended up with more food waste because we weren't using what we were picking up than if we'd have gone and bought the stuff. Oh, but that's what I'm saying. I loved it at first, but after a while, what are these? I've never cooked artichokes before or something like that. But after a while, it was like, oh God, what's in the box? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, especially in Manchester, you know, Mancunians don't like being told what to do. You know, Andy Burnham will tell you that. You know, it's that inbuilt DNA. So, you know, it's how you bring people along with you. But what Mancunians also like to do, and again, I'm only thinking for, you know, things that we can change, is, you know, if they feel that there's injustice generally, they step up. And it's finding, I don't think it's someone to get behind. It's getting people to get behind an idea that makes them think that, no, this is just wrong. This, you know, we've got to do something about it. And if we can harness that in this city, and I think, you know, throwing a little bit of protest, I don't have an issue in making people realize, especially people in positions where they can make change, that, you know, You weren't born to do that job. You may have got voted in to do that job, or you find yourself in that position. But if you've got the power to make positive change, then you have to take everybody's opinion into account. But you've also got, you know, but on the other side, the people have got to be practical, and there can't be massive changes overnight. It's got to be done slowly. Otherwise, it won't get done at all. So it's finding that. And I don't know if there is anything, you know, gluing yourself to the road isn't going to work. You know, for the thing that gets to me in terms of politicians and people in positions of power is they love a gimmick and they love a buzzword and it's like, oh yeah, we'll get behind this. And then you look into it 2 years later and they've done nothing.
But then what you're talking about there is not just about the climate change, it's political change, you know, alternatives to the current system. You know, is that something that you're involved in as well, Emma? Is it like what do you call it?
Anarchy.
Paul, I've been desperately trying to avoid anarchy because you know that is my political system of choice. He's anarchy.
Yeah, he's the Wilmslow anarchist, we call him.
It was a title.
That's the title of his autobiography when he brings it out.
I like it.
Don't make get me anonymous mask.
No,
sorry, go on.
No, I've just been listening you, to your answer.
In the debates and stuff that you're involved in, I love the climate change stuff. I just want to sort of ask about the sort of political change, you know.
Yes, so if you look at, obviously, the Green Party, the first-past-the-post system that we've got at the moment, which is how the sort of the two-party system of Conservative and Labour is really perpetuated. And Greens are campaigning for, like, proportional representation so that there'd just be a much better ability for smaller parties who are outside of those two-party system to get elected. And I do think that is integral in getting climate and social justice, because at the moment, I don't think the UK is becoming so much more diverse over the years because of globalisation and transport, and in a positive way. And I think that we can see the diversification of the UK is a really positive thing, even though it's being demonised at the moment a lot. Mm. But I think in order to represent that and to help cultivate the diversity in a positive way, there does just need to be more political parties, because to think that you can fit people into, you know, left and right like that is just really unrealistic, and it just alienates people and people get disenfranchised, and it just kind of polarizes people, and so people just don't know where they fit, and so they just don't get involved in politics. And I, to be honest, I'd be at a point of doing that now, because I just don't know where I fit in, like what box am I in? That I start, and I don't feel like there's something that represents me at the moment. And so there is that option that people just don't vote, and that kind of, that way that people who feel they do fit in are able to run the entire country, and you get massive inequalities that we've got at the moment. And so I do agree there has to be some sort of systematic change in order to allow for both climate and social justice, whatever that might look like. I don't know how we'd get that, because it'd be difficult to sort of get either of the big parties to do that, because it'd be sort of them sacrificing votes in the end. Because
my,
get
my politics depends on the issue.
Exactly.
You know, I have been a member of the Labour Party. I have been an active member of the Liberals. I haven't been an active member of the Tories. But, you know, I've recently been I was a town councillor and resigned at the start of the pandemic because I couldn't get anything done there where I could do so much more with a charity, you know. And it was, I think that the shift is more towards community groups, actual, whether they're local, regional or subject based. And also, you know, the devolution agenda is really good if done properly.
Yeah.
You know, if you're creating fiefdoms, I won't say which areas or anything like that, but if people are bringing in sort of advisors that aren't elected, then that's not good. You know, that to me, that's disillusion. You know, people can't remove people.
Who's bringing in unelected advisors? I can't, not in this day and age, surely.
Never.
would you, I mean, maybe... It's been mooted, but if you were asked to become climate advisor, young youth climate advisor to the, I don't know, to GMCA, let's say.
To Randy Durden.
That well-known American talk show host. Would you, and listen, we won't put this in if that is the case. I mean, I don't know. I know you've been on a few platforms with Andy. But would you accept that? And do you think that's something that maybe he should look at?
Yes, I probably would. There is that, I think it's easy for people, especially within the system, to go, I'm not working with you because you don't align with what I believe, which is people are free to do. But fair I think enough. Especially for climate change, it needs to stop being made into a party political issue, because it's just not. It's a human existence issue. And so that does mean working with people who maybe you don't agree with and you don't have the same political affiliation as. But I do think any position of power and influence and being able to give a platform to climate change and climate progression, people should take it. And I'd take anything, especially when there's an official position for a young person, because a lot of it is just, oh, we'll bring in young people for this one project. Well, we'll ask them a few questions and then they'll be gone. And to get kind of official and embedded positions for young people just hasn't happened yet. And if Andy Byrne or any other sort of mayor or MP or any person in a position of power, even within charities and NGOs, can create official positions for young people where they can have a say and have a voice and have a true impact rather than just be like consultational. Kind of being able to do that as a young person, I think, gives you a lot of power and a lot of sense of kind of recognition, because young people don't get paid for what they do a lot of the time, and it often that's when it feels quite tokenistic. And so when you get those official positions where you're being recognized for what you do and valued as somebody who's part of an organization just as an adult is, I think it's always amazing to see, and it feels good, and you feel kind of recognized and appreciated.
I love that answer.
I've seen it work really, really well in the past, and I know Akeem Mundell, who's when there was real bad problems down in Moss Side, and that they recruited youth ambassadors, and there was him, and there was Kimo Walker, and others, and he's an incredible activist. He can't say he's youth anymore because he's not. But now he's a teacher and he's doing pastoral work. And he's taken that, you know, he took that opportunity as a lad who was a friend of Jesse James, who was the young lad who got shot in Moss Side. And he became that ambassador for the area. And I know for a fact he still has a hell of a lot of respect in the community, you know, as a decent lad. But also he's used that opportunity, you know, he's still an activist, but he's making a career out of it, you know, and he's become a teacher and he's all that. That to me, when I watched that model over the years work, was fantastic, absolutely brilliant. Other things I've seen, you know, picking somebody and saying you are the expert in this field because they're a mate of someone. That stinks, you know. So that. You've got the two extremes there of seeing how somebody who was there firsthand and was growing up in it as, you know, Marcus Rashford. You know, I'm a big City fan. I don't usually big up United fans, United players. But what he's done, coming from Wythenshaw and then using his position, is an inspiration, you know.
Completely.
That's definitely going in. Marcus, that'll be the clip that we use as promo. Marcus Rashford is a massive inspiration to a really bitter City fan.
I didn't say anything about bitter.
No, we
political and football divide at its power.
Oh, well, that'd be a great episode if we could do that. I mean, listen, we work with people all the time that, you know, would I socialise with? No. Would they socialise with me? Probably not. But we want to make the same thing happen, which is usually the case. Even people that in positions of power who we're a little bit cynical about, I don't believe that most of them are bad people. I just think they're in a situation where sometimes it's really difficult to make the right decision. So it's great to see someone coming up through the ranks, for want of a better phrase, who has tons and tons of common sense. And I really don't mean that in a patronizing way, Emma, at all. It's just everything you say.
What Emma just said there is exactly what everybody was saying in Brexit, in the pandemic and everything. We don't give a shit about your political, what banner you're under. Will you just work together and sort this shit, sort this out? You know, and that's been going on for years and years and years now, where they've gone, hang on a minute, you're all our MPs, you're in a building down there. Stop dicking about and get your heads together and sort out this problem that's affecting all of us. You know, don't, you know, stop the partisan stuff. But instead, what did they do? The division has gone bigger and bigger and bigger. But I think that's through fear, because they know it's changing.
Yeah.
You know, and the worst thing you've got is when you've got a gang that's scared, and that's all they are. You know, these political parties, all they are is gangs. You know, and they're scared that they're losing the grip and they're losing control. And they are, and good, you know, and because there's people like you that are coming up that won't see it along those lines. Well, I hope not, you know. And I hope there's so many more out there that are thinking that way. Let's deal with the issue, not looking at, you know, which gang we're a part of, or, you know. And I think that's got a bit of future, you know.
Well, I mean, that just brings me. I mean, what do you see as the future for Emma? What's the future for you? What do you want to do?
I get asked this a lot, and people go, "Oh, do you want to be an MP? Do you want to be like,
don't be an MP?
John, this is I do. I think MPs are really valuable positions when they use correctly, and I do know so many MPs that have done amazing things. I know James Frith, who was the MP prior to James Davey, who's in currently, and James Frith did so much amazing stuff in Bury North to support the community and to bring them together, and especially young people. And it was a huge part of, I suppose, inspiring me and empowering me to sort of get involved in politics. Oh, wow. So when used correctly, kind of the position of an MP can be really valuable. But I do think I want to work internationally, I'd say, because my passion is in the climate crisis and tackling it and protecting the environment. And I want to use that to especially help bring people together. So obviously we've seen in the UK, there's that sort of political unity needed, but then there's national unity needed on an international level as well, which is something that we've never had to do. Like globalization has brought us closer together, but we're still very, very policy and ideologically divided. And I just don't think we can carry that on and tackle the climate crisis. And so I'd love to be a part of, I suppose, bringing it together and doing things together and going, right, we might be really different countries and have very different agendas, but just in order to save people in our country, we're going to put that aside and work together. And I'm not saying it'll be easy. It'll be very, very difficult. But to be a part of that and hopefully bringing people together would be amazing. So however that might play out, that is where I'm hoping to go. But any position where I can help make change and empower people to be a part of change as well is hopefully where I'd go in the future.
Listen, I love the fact that you're really passionate about what you want to do, and I think given the opportunity, there's a very good chance that you're going to make some change, some really, really positive change. And if as a charity, anything that we can do to support what you're doing locally, definitely, nationally, you know, then speak to us. And any ideas that you've got, come to us, and we'll see what we can do to try and make them work to support what you're doing.
We've looked at loads of options. We've looked at twinning projects because I've got friends in the British Council, so we've looked for how can we use the Manchester brand, because obviously we're, you know, Manx spirit. How can we use that Manchester brand to affect beyond Manchester? You know, obviously, you know, if we took our projects over to Liverpool, the people ain't going to listen to us. We have enough trouble in Salford. But taking them, like Paul said, this podcast, the whole idea of setting this up was grassroots, real, you know, whether born here or drawn here, Mancunians. And we consider, you don't have, as far as we're concerned, the people who are born here aren't necessarily Mancunians. Mancunians is a state of mind. It's a passion. It's a swagger. It's a, no, you won't stop me doing it. I'm going to carry on. Do you know what I mean? That's what it's about. So a lot of people that have been come here from other countries, and we are Greater Manchester. Me and Paul talk about this all the time. There's not one of us that aren't immigrants. You know, my family Irish, I've got Polish, we've got Nigerian. You know, you go through, and the people that come here and get that, you know, get that spirit and just go, hang on, I like this. I've got that swagger as well. You know, they're the ones that then become change makers, you know, across Greater Manchester. And that's what this was all about. It was getting out and about and finding those people across Greater Manchester and encouraging them to inspire others and develop more projects and collaborate and, you know, and that's what this, the fact that we're now getting listened to in, I don't know, we've had stuff from New York, we've had Hong Kong, we've had, so that was the whole idea of this. It was like, how do we demonstrate that Manx spirit to a much wider global audience, really? So
and I think as my image on here is becoming darker and darker and more ominous. It started to scare me now, to be fair. So I think it's probably time to wrap it up before I completely disappear. You just see the grey in my beard.
Paul, I've screenshotted it. That's the pumpkin I'm going to do in a couple of weeks.
Listen, Emma, thank you so much. Again, we say this and let you know, as a 51-year-old bloke, it takes a lot to inspire me because I've seen a lot and been around a lot. But I'm definitely inspired by people like yourselves and what you're looking to do, and keep on doing it, mate. And like I said, anything we can do to support you, we will do. And thank you very much for coming on That Great Mank Pod.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can have your tea now.